rise of Mussolini, who's a fascist and really is anti-clerical. Everything Mussolini says, you know, he said that the men in the black robes, meaning the priests, were like microbes. They were just infected, that one day he would have to wipe them out. He had never been baptized. He hadn't gotten married with his wife in a church. He had taken all the steps to show that he was against the Catholic Church. And now you see him starting to move up in power. And after 1922, he's got the March on Rome, and the fascists are moving up. You think it's going to be bad for the Vatican. But Mussolini makes a calculated gamble at one point, which is that 90%, 94% of Italy at the time is Catholic. A lot of Italians really believe in the Catholic Church. If he goes after the Catholic Church at the beginning, he risks losing the support of millions of Italians. So he decides to offer them a peace feeder, give them a deal, strike a deal with them, strike a concordat, strike an agreement in which he gives them back their sovereignty and says, you are still this little postage stamp piece of property in the middle of Rome, but you are a sovereign country, and you have all of the rights as any sovereign does. You're the equivalent of a king. And they, in fact, then turn around and say, and you, Mussolini, are the rightful leader of Italy, and we will back you, and we'll have every priest from every pulpit in a church in Italy on Sundays telling people to get behind this government of yours. And that's exactly what happens. It's smart. Now, Mussolini's only delaying, Richard, the idea of going after the church. I believe that if he had been in power long enough, if World War II hadn't interrupted and things like that, that he would have eventually moved against the church. But he never got that opportunity. But in the meantime, he became the greatest benefactor the church had in a long time, because by giving them back the sovereignty, he gave the Vatican something that no other religion on the planet has, and that's the ability to be both a religion and a country at the same time. There are only 700 to 800 men running the church in Vatican City. That's the size of it. It's not that big. And those same men, the same cardinals who make decisions about the religion, are the ones who make decisions about what the country is doing, whether they're going to recognize Palestine, or whether the Pope's going to Ecuador to make a speech, or if he's coming to the U.S. to address Congress. So there aren't two different groups. It's the same people, and they aren't necessarily good at one and good at the other. Sometimes they're good at one and terrible at the other. Sometimes they're terrible at both. But that's how they got their sovereignty back, is that striking that deal with Mussolini. And he also paid them about $1 billion, the equivalent of that in bonds, for having lost the papal states. That's the money that eventually becomes the basis for the Vatican Bank in the middle of World War II.
An interesting historical note here, that prior to Mussolini's rise through the Italian Parliament, he was democratically elected, if memory serves, but prior to that, there was a prohibition against Catholics partaking or participating in the democratic process, correct?
Right. So what happened is that you could not vote. The Pope had always barred Catholics from voting. Catholics weren't supposed to vote, which meant that the parties that were running and winning were increasingly anti-clerical. And it makes sense that if Catholics aren't going to go to vote, that's what the Pope says. The Catholics who really don't follow the Pope that carefully, look, in the United States, for instance, and in Western Europe, the official position of the Church and the current Pope, even Francis, who's viewed as a reformer by many, is that there should be no contraception other than the rhythm method, and there should be no abortion at all. And what happens? Many Catholics use regular forms of contraception like the pill or IUDs or whatever, and Catholics have abortions, and they still continue to go to church on Sunday. So there are Catholics who call themselves Catholics, who practice the faith, who ignore what the Church says. That's the same thing that happened when the Pope used to say Catholics can't vote in an election. Catholics who weren't devout would go out and vote, but the devout Catholics would not, and those were the ones who would just vote for a Catholic party line. So as a result, the Church was often at a disadvantage, and they certainly were through Mussolini.
And as a result of Mussolini's I won't call it generosity. Obviously, he had a very nefarious end game here. He hated Catholics, but he was, you know, obviously taking advantage of the situation. But you had then the unlikely situation of members of the clergy becoming members of the Italian Fascist Party.
Right, And in fact, you do have members of the clergy who in fact became members of the fascist party. You had the same thing in Germany afterwards with the priests who were members of the Nazi party, and in some cases even members of the SS. So it happened that crossover took place. And in the case of Mussolini, I think it was particularly incestuous. One of the things that happens is Italy was, I think I said a moment ago, 90 or 92%, it was actually 98% Catholic at the time that Mussolini takes power. And because of that, the men who are running the Catholic Church were in fact almost all Italian themselves. They came from large families. Those families would have 6, 7, 8 children, and many of the cardinals in the 1920s, the 1930s, came from sort of these patrician, aristocratic Italian families, where one son would be a banker, one son would be a military officer who would go on to become a general, one son would be a titan of sort of construction or industry, and one son would end up being a cardinal. You know, an Italian mother of that type of background would love to be able to say, one of my 6 sons is a cardinal inside the Vatican. So that meant that those men running the church at the time that Mussolini took power had brothers and sisters on the other side of the wall who were in fact essentially running Italy. That incestuous behavior tied the Vatican, Mussolini, and the Pope together in a unique way, and tied them together both in terms of money and where their future was going.
And as you say, with Mussolini's rise to power and this deal that he struck with the Vatican, $1 billion, this was really what provided the liquidity for the Institute for the Works of Religion, or the Vatican Bank. So is this the point when the Vatican Bank really sort of takes off? And if so, what kind of ventures were they getting involved with?
What happened still at this point, there's still what I call this interesting lag period before the Vatican Bank comes into existence. So what happens is in 1929, Mussolini strikes the deal with the Vatican. He recognizes them as a sovereign country. They recognize him. He pays them the money. And the one thing that Pius XI, who was the Pope then, was smart enough to know is he didn't know what the hell to do with the money. So he said, I don't know what to do with all of this. He has to find somebody on the outside, a lay official who understands how to run it and how to invest it. So they did this search, and they end up coming up with a guy called Bernardino Nogaro. Nogaro, we overuse the word, Richard, you know, people overuse the word genius. They call people genius all the time or inspired or whatever. But Nogaro really was a financial wizard. He was doing arbitrage just at the beginning of when it was taking place. He came into the Vatican in 29, and here was a guy who took the money. He invested it into real estate in London, some of which they still have. He put it into American stocks, but basically he made offshore accounts. He started to move the money around, and he conservatively invested it so that it started to grow. He's the guy who stays there from 1929 until 1958. So in World War II, there's a new pope. The old pope dies in 1939, just before the war breaks out. The new pope is Pius XII. He keeps Nogaro. He has a couple of doubts about him. They do an investigation into Nogaro, and they determine he's really a good guy who's not taking any money. He's not doing anything wrong. Let's keep him. He's running the finances fine. And it's in 1942, in June of 42, the middle of World War II, when the Vatican Bank is founded. So why do you think to yourself, what do they need a bank for? It's a sort of a cross between a central bank and an investment bank. It's an unusual bank because it doesn't make any loans. It never makes a loan out. It doesn't have to report a profit. It has only one shareholder according to the charter, which was drawn up between the Pope and Nogaro, and that's the Pope himself. It answers only the Pope. Its files originally for the first 50 years were destroyed every 10 years. It was supposed to, because that was just how they operated. Nobody could see how it was making money or what it was doing except for the Pope. It didn't report to anybody else, not even other divisions inside the Vatican.
And my word, it makes the Federal Reserve look like the sort of the pinnacle of transparency.
Absolutely. Hard to imagine. If you had to say, is there anybody, you know, that makes the Federal Reserve look like it is a model of transparency, would be the Vatican Bank.
All right, Gerald, we're going to head into a break here. Hold on. Stay with Gerald Posner as well as we talk about the rise of the Vatican Bank. Give us a sense of the scope, magnitude, influence of the Vatican Bank. For example, how would it compare in assets to, say, Goldman Sachs?
It'd be much smaller. As a matter of fact, Richard, it's only like a mid-sized bank in the U.S., mid-sized community bank. It's dealing with, we now know from the first balance sheets that have been shown in the last few years, between $8 and $10 billion a year. So small in terms of Wall Street size, but significant in terms of Vatican size, especially when you consider that all that money's flowing through, much of it in cash, because remember, they are only representing religious institutions and priests, and the religious institutions and orders are taking a lot of donations in terms of cash. So it's coming in that way. And you're also dealing with a country in terms of the Vatican that had no law against money laundering until 2011, had no law against the financing of terrorism until 2011, had no limit on the amount of money that could be brought in as cash through the border, be like $10,000 or 10,000 euros until they passed it in 2012. And that's only because the Europeans pushed them because they're now using the euro. But before that, no regulations at all. They accepted physical deposits, which meant truckloads literally of gold after World War II, as I talk about, that arrived at the doorstep of the Vatican, and then the gold disappears, and we're talking about what happened to it. And, you know, before you were mentioning in the break the extent to which the Vatican does so much in terms of charity, the Catholic Church, and they do, I mentioned in the book that they're the largest charities in the world, and at the same time, because sometimes Catholics will say to me who haven't read the book, oh, it's anti-Catholic. And Catholics who have read the book say, whoa, I didn't know this at all. I'm really glad I read it. And that's because it's not anti-Catholic. It's a history. And like any history, it has low points and high points. And there are, unfortunately, a lot of low points in this history, but they're there for people to learn from. And we were talking before about the formation of the Vatican Bank. You know, we went over 1935. There was a war in Ethiopia that Mussolini launched. The Vatican sort of exhorted Italians to join it and made money off the munitions. They were invested in the munitions companies that were involved in the war from Nagorno putting them in. In 1933, going back a couple of years earlier, the Vatican was the first country in the world to recognize Hitler. Hitler had no country recognize him as the Chancellor of Germany, as the new government being legitimate, until the Church did. They had a deal with him, and as part of that deal, the Church collects a tax in Germany, which they still do, which is voluntary. It used to be voluntary, 8 to 10% of your income. Hitler agreed to collect that at the source, like a payroll tax, and pay it to the Vatican. In the middle of World War II, it was bringing $100 million a year to the Vatican. It was incredibly big to their budget. So, you know, we forget about that. And then, as I said, they formed the Vatican Bank, and the reason why, because the Americans and British have a so-called blacklist in which they're looking to stop countries from doing business with the Nazis. They put every country in Europe on the blacklist, including Monaco, San Marino, Liechtenstein, Andorra, Switzerland. The only country that wasn't put on by 1942 was the Vatican. They were left off because it was the only sovereign European country that did not have its own banking system. And then what does the Vatican do? In June of 42, they form the banking system. They create the Vatican Bank. That allows them to go dark. And from that point on, they're doing business in the black. The U.S. cannot see them. They're trading money back and forth. We only know it after the war with Germany. And as I disclose in this book, for the first time, they invest in, through Italian proxies, in Italian and German insurance companies, including the biggest ones like Allianz and Generali. And in 1943 and 44, those companies start to cheat the life insurance policies of Jews being sent to Auschwitz. They know they're going, and they say, you know, there's a cash value to these policies. They take them off the books, and it increases their profits, outsized profits. And the Vatican, through its investments, earns the benefit of that. Did the Pope know about it? I'm sure not, because they didn't want to know. All they wanted to know is that the Vatican Bank was making money, and it came out of the gate roaring with money.
You mentioned World War II, Hitler. Interesting. I mean, the Third Reich rolled over France, rolled through Poland, and yet they did not invade the Vatican. Why not?
Well, you know, it's a great question. The Vatican was afraid of that all the time. They were afraid that Hitler was going to turn against them and keep the tax money, which was one of the things. They thought that he might come in and take over Vatican City and take the Pope back a prisoner to Germany. 70% of the top Nazis were, in fact, Catholics, although many of them Catholics in name only. The rest were Lutheran. The Pope thought that he might be able to bring them back to some form of Catholicism at some point. He feared, he had been a nuncio to Germany, an ambassador to Germany before he became Pope. He spoke German fluently, all his aides were German, he liked things German. He thought he might be able to convince even Hitler and the top Nazis to soften their position against the Church. And he feared communism, the Reds, the Bolsheviks, and Stalin much more, because he knew they were equal opportunity atheists. They were closing up churches and synagogues, moving against the Orthodox faith, the Christian Orthodox faith, and everybody at once. So while he thought there might be a possibility of moderating Hitler, he knew there was no possibility of doing that with Stalin. So it shoved him closer to the Nazis. And even when Mussolini fell and the Germans took over Rome in 1943, they didn't move against the Vatican. As a matter of fact, they rounded up the Jews of Rome for the first time because Mussolini had been slow and reluctant to do that. They marched them within eyesight of the Pope's window, and the Pope made no protest at all. They shipped them out to Auschwitz. So the relationship with the Vatican and the Third Reich was strained at times. The Pope didn't speak out strongly against the Third Reich time and time again, and I discussed that in a long chapter about why he didn't, but some of it was clearly financial, and I set that out in this book for the first time.
To what extent does or did the Pope oversee the day-to-day operation of the Vatican Bank? Would he receive a daily or a weekly briefing, for example?
Right. Absolutely critical. Here's the Pope. He's the only shareholder of the Vatican Bank. So is it the type of thing where you're the titular shareholder and you don't do anything and it's run down at a minion level? One of the things to remember, as opposed to the U.S. government or what people think of as governments at all, that because it's only 700 to 800 people in Vatican City, it's much smaller, and it depends on the style of the Pope. So some popes have a removed style in terms of finances. The Polish Pope, some people may remember John Paul II. He wasn't into finances at all. He wasn't into finances when he was the Cardinal of Krakow, and he wasn't that concerned about finances when he came into Vatican City. The German Pope, who just resigned, the last one, Benedict, before Francis, not concerned about finances. But Pius XII, the wartime Pope, who was Pope from 1939 to 1958, he was into finances, but more than that, Richard was a micromanaging pope. He was a guy into the details. When telexes would come in from his different ambassadors around the world, they normally would go over to the Secretary of State's office in the Vatican. They would instead go to him as well as a copy. He would answer them personally. He knew what was going on in a different way. He met with the head of the Vatican Bank once a week. He got those reports and updates. And so in terms of Pius, I would say that he's probably the most involved pope in terms of the money and finances.
Let's circle back to Roberto Calvi, let's see if we can sort of, you know, bring that to a conclusion as best you can. What did Calvi's, perhaps his murder, have to do with the Vatican Bank? I mean, he was involved in the Vatican Bank. He had close ties with the Vatican Bank. But what is your research, where has it led you in terms of motivation or the motive for his death?
Well, Calvi was one of the most prominent bankers in Italy, and was involved with the Vatican Bank, with the American archbishop who was running the bank, a fellow called Paul Marcinkus, in a whole host of illegal activity, which I detail for pages, these hundreds of millions of dollars in fake back-to-back loans in which the church would earn money from those, questionable deposits that came from people that were laundering money or trying to avoid taxes at the very least. And Marcinkus was actually on these offshore banks as a director together with Calvi. They got in over their head, and at one point near the end when the whole thing starts to unravel, Calvi goes to Marcinkus at the Vatican Bank for more money. He needs yet more to bail him out because the entire thing's about to fall down. He's over $1 billion in debt with all of these fake ghost companies, and no one quite knows that there's no money behind the paper tiger. And Marcinkus doesn't give him any more money, but at this point he gives him two letters that essentially says, we, the Vatican, stand behind most of these ghost companies and we'll back them up. Calvi goes out and then tries to raise more money with that. Those letters are fake because the Vatican Bank made Calvi give him a letter back secretly at the same time that said, by the way, I know that these letters that you've given me of patronage and support really don't mean anything, and you really won't give me any money at all. So the Vatican was involved in what was an extensive fraud, so much so, Richard, that when Calvi ends up dead, what happens? The Italian prosecutors try to, they indict Marcinkus, head of the Vatican Bank and Archbishop, and his two top lay assistants, trying to get to him for a whole host of felonies and white-collar crimes, and the Vatican says, no way. You can't touch them because we're a sovereign country. And those three men stay inside Vatican City. The Italians go all the way up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court eventually rules you cannot extradite somebody who's a citizen of Vatican City out of the Vatican to stand trial in Italy for crimes committed in Italy. It was a shocking decision, and it protected them and protected the Vatican Bank. And you have to remember just one quick footnote to this. Not only did Calvi end up dead, but the man who did business with the Vatican Bank beforehand, that some of your listeners may remember, Michele Sindona, was one of the biggest titans in all of Italy, who had been the Vatican Bank's original businessman of sorts, was the one who not only ended up breaking the law repeatedly and ended up in jail, but when he's in jail for the second day after being convicted in Italy of having killed the prosecutor, and he was called God's banker because he was so close to the Pope at the time in the 60s, in the 70s, he ends up all of a sudden grabbing at his throat. They have him in a special wing of the jail they've built for him because they're afraid somebody may try to kill him. And they have his food monitored. It's prepared in a separate part of the kitchen. And then it's taken with a sealed lid down to his jail cell where he is monitored 24 hours a day by three different shifts of guards and a television camera. And then they take the lid off the food and he's able to have the food. He has his meal on the second day, grabs at his throat, and he says, I can't breathe, I've been poisoned. He keels over. It turns out to be cyanide poisoning, and the Italian courts look into it, and they say, suicide. So that happens to the first guy who deals with the Vatican Bank, and then Calvi ends up under a bridge hanging from a rope around his neck, and they say, suicide. You know, something doesn't start to add up here after a while.
And we should mention that Calvi had, his pockets were filled with rocks. And, you know, after, if he had in fact climbed up that scaffolding on Blackfriars Bridge, they would have found, you know, rust stains and so forth under his fingernails or on his clothing, none of that. So as you say, very, very suspicious. Well, connections between Calvi and the infamous P2 Masonic Lodge, what is that all about?
Yeah, I mean, P2 is absolutely something, you know. Sometimes I know before your first guest had said that you like to use fiction because you can do things in fiction you can't do in nonfiction. It gives you a different thing. But I must say that even the best novelist would have trouble coming up with P2 and believing that it really could be real, because P2 is a secret organization, Freemasons, which the Vatican, by the way, has always been against. Remember, the Vatican doesn't like Freemasons. They fought them. They viewed them as dangerous, and they try to stamp them out. So in Italy, because the Pope said being a Freemason was not allowed, they were essentially illegal. So there's a secret Freemason organization called Propaganda Due, and the shorthand is P2 for it, and it forms in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s. By the 60s, when it really comes into its heyday, it is about 1,500 people that really is a state within a state. Its members include everybody from four sort of cabinet ministers, about 50 generals, admirals, some of Italy's most important industrialists, financiers, public prosecutors, judges, journalists, even intelligence operatives. That membership roster was stunned Italy so much that when they moved against it to try to take it out, it wasn't just an exclusive club. It was sort of the people who could run the country in many ways. And as a result of that, Calvi was a member. Sindona, who I mentioned a second ago, who died of cyanide poisoning in his jail cell and did business with the Vatican Bank, was a member of it. And there were rumors that Marcinkus, the archbishop who ran the Vatican Bank, was a member, but when they found the membership rolls, Marcinkus' name was not on, and he always denied that. But there's no question that the men around Calvi and around Sindona, as well as them, the ones who were transferring the money for the Vatican Bank, the guy called Gelli, who ran the P2, were all close to the Pope, all involved in the Vatican Bank, and all making a lot of money off of it.
Has the Vatican Bank ever been audited, or has anyone ever attempted to audit the Vatican Bank?
Yeah, well, yes, it's had an audit of sorts in the last few years. There's been two audits. Here's where the story is changing, and this is why I say that this book ends on a positive note or on a hopeful note for all Catholics who otherwise sort of get nervous that this is just too bad of a history. The positive note that it ends on is things are changing, and I think that I live in Miami, so for me, when I talk about the craziest possible days of something that was bad, I talk about the cocaine cowboy days, as they were here in Miami in the 80s. The cocaine cowboy days of the Vatican Bank may be over, and going forward, it may become just a boring, mundane bank that has an occasional scandal and financial problems here and there, but on the whole, isn't involved in what I call making profits off of the Holocaust or involved with mobsters, and as it was in the 80s and 90s, or becoming a place for slush funds for at least top politicians. The reason for that is, you said, is it audited? It used to be in the dark to everybody, including other parts of the Vatican. And then what changed it was that in 1999, Italy decided that it was going to adopt the euro, and it gave up the lira. The Vatican used the lira for its own currency, so they had to decide what they were going to do. Were they going to publish and print their own money, or were they going to go ahead and use the common currency in Europe? And they had this debate about it. They decided to go with the euro, but what they didn't realize at that time, Richard, was that by going with the euro, they would be subject to evaluation by Brussels and the European Union to see whether their central bank was compliant with international banking rules and regulations, because they have a rule, this sort of scale that they look at. You can be an F, in which case you're completely an outlaw bank. You can be an A, in which case you're compliant, you're doing everything right. And the Vatican had all of a sudden start to make sure that it could pass the first inspection from what's called MoneyVal, these European inspectors. That's why earlier we talked about the first law against the financing of terrorism, 2011. They're cleaning up their act. First law against money laundering, 2011, they're cleaning up their act. They've closed more than 3,000 accounts in the last few years. Those were accounts that belonged to everyone from mobsters to people who should never have had them, to wealthy Italians who were not paying taxes and putting their money in this bank as though it was an offshore bank in the heart of Rome. So the fact that the Europeans have come in to look at the bank and they grade them a C, they've given the whole list of things they still have to improve. They're not an F, but they're not on the white list yet, means that the Vatican is cleaning up its act. It has no choice to, or would have to stop using the euro.
And we are back with Gerald Posner, author of God's Bankers, A History of Money and Power at the Vatican. Gerald, before we dip into the calls, and we have a full board, not surprisingly, let me ask you about the sudden death of Pope John Paul I back in 1978, 33 days after his election, relatively young man, 65, in good health by all accounts. Official cause of death was natural causes. Any connection there with the Vatican Bank? Was he, for example, trying to reform the Vatican Bank?
Yeah, he was, in the sense that he was known not to be a friend of Bishop Marcinkus, who was running the Vatican Bank, who already had some problems. And a lot of people thought that when this Pope came in, that he would sweep Marcinkus aside, in part for money, because years earlier, Marcinkus had pushed through the right for Calvi, who ended up dead in London, to buy a bank in Venice. It was a Catholic bank, and it was sort of the gem of Catholic banks in Venice, which is where this Pope came from. He was the cardinal there. He didn't like it. He went back to Marcinkus to argue against the sale. Marcinkus dismissed him very abruptly. So when he becomes the Pope years later, people think that's the end of Marcinkus, and then 33 days later, as you said, he's dead. So it looks suspicious. I looked into that as much as I could. Of course, Richard, in the end, you can never determine it with 100% because of the fact that there was no autopsy done and the Pope was buried. But what I did determine is that I think he died of natural causes, but there were many people who wanted him dead and they celebrated his death. But more than that, the Vatican had a cover-up after the death, which is why so many people think it was a murder. The cover-up was not of a murder, but it was in fact for their own puritanical reasons. A nun had discovered him dead at 5:36 o'clock in the morning. She used to bring him his coffee every day. That was the routine. The Vatican thought that that would look terrible, that a woman, even if it was a nun, was the first person to find the Pope in his bedroom that early in the morning, that people would think it involved sex or some other thing. They lied about the book that he had. They didn't do the autopsy. They covered up a whole series of things. So when you see the cover-up, you think something suspicious, and it is. But when you realize what they're covering up, it's not in this case a murder, but there is no doubt that there were people who were glad that he had a very short papacy.
All right, let's go to the phones, and the first-time caller is John from Des Moines, Iowa. Good morning, John. Welcome to Coast to Coast.
Yes, Richard, you answered my question already.
What did Pope John Paul I intend to do with the Vatican Bank?
Well, that was what no one's really clear of. So, you know, I think what happens, Richard, is that when you have a very short period, and there's nothing shorter than 33 days, but even, you know, when you have a time when you're head of a country or head of an organization and you're only there for a short while, people tend to look back on that short period and they put into your tenure whatever they wanted and hoped that you would do. So, you know, if they think you were going to eliminate the Vatican Bank, they think he would have done that. If he was going to fire Marcinkus, he would have done that the next day. If he was going to approve contraception and allow abortion, he was going to do that. So they sort of put into him all of their hopes and expectations for reforms. I think he, based upon the way that he ran his parish, his diocese in Venice, he was not a hands-on micromanager when it came to finances, but he was, I think, very likely to get a new head of the Vatican Bank. That would have been about as much of the changes he was going to do. Look at, when I say to you that Francis, the current Pope, is a reformer, which he is, he's the real deal when it comes to the finances and Vatican Bank. Remember, he's being forced to in some ways. Anybody who's Pope today would have to do that if the Vatican wants to stay in the Euro. If it had not been for that, I don't think any Pope would have really tackled the Vatican Bank with vigor or enthusiasm, because it's such a moneymaker for this small government that they talk about changing it. They always talk about changing it, but they wouldn't do it unless they had to.
The wild card line, Jeff is in Culver City. Jeff, good morning. Welcome to Coast.
Yeah, how you doing, Richard and Mr. Posner? My mother.
So to Jeff's question, they do spend a lot of money, more than Catholic Charities, more than any other charities in the world in terms of spreading it out. But the refugee issue is a very interesting one, Jeff, because refugees are flooding into Europe. It's a problem that, you know, we see the migrants coming in from Syria and across from Tunisia and Algeria on boats, and, you know, they're risking their lives to get to Italy and to Greece and to other parts of southern Europe, and Europe's trying to figure out how to move the migrants around Europe and how to absorb all of this. The Pope believes that the migrants should have pretty open access to come in, and some churches in Germany in that have given safe haven status to migrants. If you can reach a church, they'll consider you safe, and they'll put you up with room and board until the country decides to keep you there. So the question is, how much is the Catholic Church going to spend on migrants? How much is it going to spend on refugees? That's an open question. We still need to see that. We're talking tens of millions of dollars that have to be spent here at some point. And I do think that this is a Pope, because Jeff mentioned in his question, Richard, public relations. This is a Pope who understands public relations. He's a populist. He knows what a good soundbite is, better than some popes in the last, several decades. And he's trying to expand the popularity of the church, because in the end, the church is worried about numbers, meaning the numbers of people that it has. It wants more and more numbers. Every church wants that. And they're losing numbers and worshipers in Central and South America. He's a South American from Argentina, to evangelicals, who are convincing people that the Catholic Church has lost its way, that it's just a corrupt institution, and the real faith in Jesus to be found in these evangelical offshoots. And so as a result, the Pope is fighting back, and they are trying to use the public relations to make themselves once and again the one true Christian church. It will take a long time to do that, but they're making that effort.
To the international line we go. Terry is in Vancouver. Terry, good morning. Welcome to Coast.
Thank you very much for taking my call. I'd like to ask Mr. Posner if the Catholic Church is invested in munitions or arms at all.
Yes, Terry, that's a great question, because one of the things that happens in this book, and I talk about it, is that there's a period in which the Catholic Church, through the Vatican Bank, is invested in companies in Italy. And what happens in the 1960s is, to their great embarrassment, in 67 and 68, Italian reporters uncover the fact that the Vatican is invested in this company then called Istituto Farmacologico Serono, which is a pharmaceutical company that made birth control pills. So that was bad. They didn't like that at all. They were also invested in Udon, a military weapons manufacturer. They had some money in Beretta, a gun maker, a Monte Carlo casino, and a printing firm that published porn. So all of that sort of led them to divest themselves of those private company investments, and they got out of that business. But even back in the 30s, in the mid-30s, when Italy went into Ethiopia and they had the invasion that was a sort of a slaughter of colonial Ethiopia, the Vatican was invested at that time in munitions makers and were making money off the arms companies that helped fuel Mussolini's invasion. So they have been invested in arms companies before. They have been invested in companies that did make birth control pills. They try to divest themselves of that today and do socially conscious investments, which really means they're investing in real estate, in property, although it turned out a year ago, to their embarrassment, a year and a half ago, it was discovered that they own the building that houses the largest gay bathhouse in Rome. They all sort of said, oh, we didn't know that. But, of course, a couple of priests who work inside the Vatican, higher-ranking priests, lived upstairs in the Vatican apartments in that building. So somehow they didn't notice what was happening on the first floor. But that happens time and time again to them.
Terry, thanks for the call. How does the bank work? Can I invest in the bank? Can I deposit money in the Vatican Bank?
No, that's the great thing. So, Richard, what happens is you can't just walk in and open an account. The only branch in the world happens to be in Vatican City. So there's no other branch and no other church, no other diocese or parish or anywhere else. So the only branch is physically in Vatican City. It's the only bank in the world, by the way, that has ATM machines that has Latin as one of the languages. True, as a little side point.
That's great.
The only people that can open up accounts are either citizens of Vatican City, and by the way, it's the only country in the world that owns more property outside of its physical country than the country itself, and it's the only country in the world in which its citizens constantly change. And what I mean by that is, if you go to work as an American priest to work in Vatican City, as long as you're there, whether you're a cardinal, a bishop, or whatever else, in Vatican City, you get the citizenship of Vatican City. If you return, you retire, you come back to America to a diocese here, you're no longer a citizen of Vatican City. You lose it when you leave the city itself. So the citizenship always changes. The number's about the same, but who is a citizen changes, so those people can open up accounts. Then religious orders can open up accounts. And this is the big loophole. What's been a loophole for the mafia in previous years, because they laundered money through there, a loophole for wealthy Italians, was this religious charities, the charities that could open up businesses or accounts there. So there were charities that were fakes. Nobody knew they were fakes. They would open up an account because you would find a compliant priest to open that account up for you, and then you would funnel cash in there, and it was safe, it wasn't taxed, and you didn't have to worry about it. So all you had to do was find a priest or a bishop who was willing to do it for you, pay them somehow, and they opened up that account, and you were up and running. And the thing that's so perplexing about it for investigators and DEA and tax agents and everything else is, because it's in Rome, you don't even have to do a wire transfer. When people wire transfer money into an offshore bank in Singapore or Hong Kong or the Bahamas or Panama, they leave a wire trace that can be tracked by a government. Inside the Vatican Bank, you literally just have to go in with a suitcase of cash. You go across the street. Remember, there's no customs to go from Rome into the Vatican City, for those who haven't been there. If you're on a street corner in Rome, the light turns green, You cross the street, and the next thing you know, when you're on the other side of the street, you're in Vatican City. That's how it's seamless. So when you go across the street and you have cash with you, they accept physical deposits. You give it to the friendly priest who's helping you out by having created the charitable foundation. Like we talked about before, the president of Italy, the prime minister, had an account called the Francis Spellman Foundation. Some are called the Loreto Sisters, some the Little Sisters of Assisi. These were all fake accounts used in the 90s and into the 2000s by politicians in Italy. And the money is deposited, and there's no trace of it even in a wire transfer. That's why I think the Vatican Bank, for a while, was the world's favorite offshore bank, especially for wealthy Italians.
And what would happen if the Vatican Bank were to become insolvent? Would the Catholic Church essentially be bankrupt?
Yeah, the Catholic Church would certainly be... The Vatican itself would be in a great deal of trouble. And as a matter of fact, this almost happened in the 80s when Marcinkus, the American archbishop who was running it and doing business with Sindona, the businessman who ends up dead of cyanide in jail after his second day, and with Calvi who ends up hanging under a London bridge. After those two, when the Italians indicted Marcinkus but the Vatican wouldn't turn him over, the Vatican ended up paying $244 million, which for them was a lot of money at the time in cash, to a group of banks as a settlement. Now, you'll love this, Richard. They paid it under an agreement that was hammered out for over a year for, quote, I'm not kidding you, moral considerations. They wouldn't say for wrongdoing or because we did anything wrong or we're involved in these criminal back-to-back loans. For moral considerations, they paid out $250 million. And when you said, would they go bankrupt? The sex abuse scandal, which I cover in only one chapter in this book, but I cover it only from a financial perspective, shows you how wise the Catholic Church is when it comes to this. The Vatican, when the sex abuse cases started to break in Rome, they thought this was a peculiarly American phenomenon because they viewed Americans as very puritanical. They said, oh, this is only happening in America. Well, it was an international problem for them eventually from Ireland to England to Australia. But at that time, they thought it was America only. They brought the lawyers in. And they made sure that every diocese was separate from every other diocese, legally separate entities, so that if one went down, it wouldn't bring down a neighboring diocese that was wealthy. And as a result, 11 dioceses in America have gone bankrupt since the sex abuse crises have broke because of the payments that they've had to make in settlements for pedophile priests. But those 11 that went bankrupt didn't affect any other diocese, and they didn't affect the Vatican because the Pope at the time, Benedict, the German Pope, was worried that some clever American lawyer would sue him, saying you are the ultimate employer of these pedophile priests. And that's exactly what happened. A number of American lawyers sued Benedict, saying you, the Pope, you're responsible. We want to get money from the Vatican as well. These bankrupt dioceses aren't good enough. We're going to come after you. And finally, after a number of court decisions, the American appellate courts ruled that the Pope cannot be sued in an American court over the sex abuse crisis because he is a sovereign of a foreign country. That's when the sovereign part came to the Vatican's benefit. So those suits were all dismissed against the Pope.
Gerald Posner, my guest, and we will continue. Of course, an historical resignation. I'm not sure, but that may have been unprecedented. I don't know that the Pope has ever resigned before. And I'm wondering whether that has anything to do with the Vatican Bank.
The short answer is yes. It was one of the things he was faced with three different issues. One was the Vatican Bank and scandals inside the bank that he was unable to quell. His head of the bank was dismissed over money laundering issues in 2012, and he wasn't quite sure how to handle that. The other part was that there was questions of sort of what I call a gay lobby inside the Vatican, and there was a report done by several cardinals, three cardinals to him, that there was the equivalent of a casting couch at some level inside the Vatican, and he wasn't sure what to do about that. And I think the last issue for Benedict was that he was the wrong person to be Pope at the wrong time. And as a result, there was a point at which he threw up his hands and said, I can't take it. He also had a leak going on. Batty leaks, in which his butler was leaking documents out that were embarrassing him and the rest of the Vatican. So for him, it was the perfect storm, and he just stepped aside.
All right, and we are back with Gerald Posner, investigative journalist and author of God's Bankers. let's talk about Pope Francis and his efforts to clean house at the Vatican Bank. It's been discussed and written about in places like Huffington Post, and they're saying this may be just too tough a nut for him to crack. What do you think?
Well, I think he, you know, he was faced with a very interesting thing, Richard, when he became Pope, and that was that the Vatican Bank was in the middle of yet another one of its great scandals. The bank president had resigned, and it wasn't clear where they were going. There were money laundering allegations. The Italians were jumping up and down again. The Europeans weren't happy. So one of the options for him was to eliminate the Vatican Bank, just to do away with it. And that would have solved the problem once and for all, because the Vatican does not need the Vatican Bank. It's a 2,000-year-old institution. It did without it for 1,940 years. And if it didn't have the Vatican Bank, it would do all of its banking through other banks, correspondent banks, just like it did before. So it would be using Chase and German banks and UBS and all of that. All it would lose is the ability to have that extra layer of secrecy. And as a sovereign country, it wouldn't feel as though it had its central bank, but doesn't issue its own bonds, it doesn't issue its own currency, it doesn't make loans. So if he had had the courage to just eliminate it, then we wouldn't even be having this discussion going forward. But instead, there was a lot of resistance to the idea of getting rid of it. People in the Vatican, the cardinals, the traditionalists like it because they think it gives them some prestige to have their own bank. Instead of just saying, by the way, you're a country, where's your bank? And they say, oh, it's not. We're banking through J.P. Morgan. Doesn't sound as good. So they insisted that he keep it. He went along with that. He is putting in through reforms aggressively. He's bringing in good people from the outside. I have a chapter, you know, in God's Bankers called The Swiss James Bond. It's about a guy who's been hired by them, a young guy who looks like he's out of central casting, who cleaned up Liechtenstein and made it from an F as sort of a money laundering haven into an A, and now he's doing the same thing at the Vatican. So they've put in place a lot of rules and regulations that if they have a chance to play out, I think will do the job. The question is, will he be Pope long enough so that the Vatican Bank can get cleaned up? Because you can't change the underlying culture of these traditionalists who like to operate in secret overnight. So he needs to be there at least 3 to 5 years more. He's 78, becoming 79 years old. He's talked about the fact he thinks he's going to have a short papacy, and I don't mean that in terms of like a John Paul I, that somebody's about to knock him off tomorrow. He just doesn't think it's going to be a long papacy, but he needs to be in there long enough to make these changes hold, because otherwise a new pope comes in, doesn't like them, can sort of revert some of them back.
What is the significance of the Catholic Church, the cardinals, electing a Jesuit to the papacy?
Yeah, I think it's significant in the sense that, you know, we talked earlier in the conversation about how Jesuits had always been taboo to think of them ever at the head of the church because they were the radical part of the church, the soldiers of Christ who sort of pushed the hardest ideology, and so that you didn't really trust the Jesuits at the top because they were too much ideologues and not enough pragmatists to make the deals. Remember, becoming pope is supposed to be, as Catholics think about it, the Holy Spirit comes into the conclave of cardinals, the meeting of cardinals after the death of a pope, and gives them the feeling of who should be pope, and that's how it's selected. That's how it happens in theory. In practice, as I show in the book, and you know this, I go through the papal elections in modern times, and they are internecine battles that have everything short of bloodshed. In the old days, they used to have bloodshed because they used to kill competing candidates to get in the final part of the balloting. But here, they really throw elbows, they get in, there's a lot of dirt thrown, it's very hard competition, people want to be pope, and the traditionalists against the reformists are always battling it out. In the end, the reformists won this last one because they put in Francis over several traditionalists, and they got a Jesuit in at the same time, but he is shaking things up, so much so, they may not go for a Jesuit again, this may be the last time.
All right, let's go east of the Rockies, and Danielle has been very patient in Cleveland. Danielle, welcome to Coast to Coast.
Thank you, Richard. You are an especially poignant and a few years back that the Catholic Church had been seeking sovereign status by the State Department in this country for many, many years, and were finally recognized as such by the Bill Clinton administration, I believe in 1996. Relative to that, does that now mean that the Catholic officials and property within the United States is considered protected under diplomatic immunity, and to what extent? And my second question is also that same sovereign status within the European Union and the Vatican's position on the current conditions in Greece, since Greece is fundamentally opposed in their orthodoxy. And I thank you very much, and I will take my answers off the air. Thank you.
All right, Danielle. Thank you. All right, Gerald.
Yeah, great questions from Danielle. First of all, she's absolutely right that it was finally the Clinton administration that did go through the final parts of recognizing that relationship with the Vatican as a full sovereign. Before that, the limitation had been, there had been a tremendous amount of, sort of pushback against even sending over an envoy in World War II. When Roosevelt finally sent an envoy over, Protestants didn't like the idea that the Vatican was a sovereign country and that we were going to have a relationship with the papist believers, all of us. And so Roosevelt had to not make it a full ambassadorial position, but had to send it over instead just as an envoy. It wasn't until Clinton that we finally made it a full ambassador's position. And I talk in the book, by the way, Danielle, about how once it's an ambassador's position, we used it under John Paul II and under Reagan, and Reagan's really the one who made it the full ambassador's position. Clinton changes it, but Reagan's really the one who pushes it up. How we use that position to sort of go into an alliance with the Pope and the CIA, and we sent money over through the Vatican Bank, millions of dollars to solidarity to topple communism. How they put together a car, an old SUV, and they put in false sides with gold ingots from Swiss banks in the side of the car and at the bottom, and they had a priest drive it from Rome to Gdansk, and how the Vatican Bank put in black money from the CIA into the Polish fight. So you see all of that take place. Once the ambassador's in place from Reagan on, and then again with Clinton, it just keeps happening. But it does not mean that all of the property in the United States that belongs to the Catholic Church is automatically sovereign. Those churches, the schools, the institutions, the homeless shelters that are run by the Catholic Church, they belong to the diocese or the organization that's running them. Sometimes Knights of Columbus, there are these fraternal organizations or the church itself. None of the cardinals in the different cities have sovereign status. A Vatican official, a secretary of state, as they call it in the Vatican, or somebody who works for the Foreign Office or works for the archives and is a citizen of Vatican City and an official there traveling in the United States, would have sovereign immunity and would have that sovereign status. The same in Europe. The churches themselves and the institutions in those countries don't. Only Vatican officials do. There was recently a fight with one of the Central American countries with the ambassador who was being charged with sex crimes and was using sovereign immunity to try to avoid being prosecuted. This Pope, Francis, finally stripped him of that sovereign immunity and said, you're going to be prosecuted. Finally, regarding Greece, you're right, it's not a large Catholic country. It's basically the Greek Orthodox, so they don't have an enormous Catholic population that they need to play to there. But on the whole, the church has been quiet about the problem in Greece. They haven't spoken out too much except to say that they believe that austerity should not be used as a tool that breaks the backs of people inside a country. This goes along with what Richard talked about in the very beginning of the conversation. This Pope speaks all the time, excoriates capitalism, even though the Vatican Bank practices it very well. And he doesn't like the idea of austerity coming in so that the lenders from Northern Europe can benefit. He knows that is an issue in Italy, as it is in Spain, two big Catholic countries. So what happens in Greece could play out later in Italy, Spain, and Portugal. He's very aware of that. And as a result, he's been more sympathetic to Cyprus and the Greeks than he has been to the European Union.
And while we're on the, thank you for the call, Danielle, while we're on the subject of Greece and puffs of white smoke, bringing it back to the Pontiff, reports now coming in that we are getting a white smoke from the Euro summit, and apparently a deal has been reached with Greece and its creditors. And the Euro group is announcing that a privatization fund will be set up. Greece has been, it's been demanded of Greece that they set up a $50 billion asset fund, I guess sort of collateral, a privatization, this will be privatized in the future, $50 billion worth of assets to be held in trust in Greece, and it will be headed up by experts, namely creditors. Some are calling a trust fund, others are calling it a fund of shame, and it still has to be approved by the Greek Parliament on Wednesday. This will be very interesting.
It is remarkable that, you know, Tsipras essentially ran, you know, and convinced the country to vote no against austerity, and then did a U-turn immediately afterwards and sort of said, okay, let's, you know, come to some austerity. That's the pressure that was on Greece is absolutely tremendous. It is clear across the board. And that's also, it goes back a little bit, Richard, to what we were talking about before, is why is the Vatican Bank this institution that's prided itself upon being secret and never having anything open and being more secret in that sense than even the Federal Reserve? Why are they allowing anybody to look into it like Brussels? Because they're using the euro, and it's not so easy to leave. It's the club that, you know, people can join, but they can never leave. And Greece is proving that, and the Vatican sort of squirming sometimes by having to let the Brussels regulators come in to look at the Vatican Bank, but they know there's no other choice because that's the price for using the euro. The creditors and the bankers in Europe have a tremendous amount of control in these situations, even sometimes when it comes to the Catholic Church.
And not to digress too much, but I just find it interesting, this Greece situation. The many people may not be aware that the number one debt transgressor of the 20th century was not Greece, it's Germany. They've been insolvent on three separate occasions, and in 1953, about 20 countries, including Greece, forgave much of Germany's debt.
Well, the great thing is, I listened to a psychologist the other day say that one of the reasons that Germans are so unforgiving of the Greek debt is because they've been through these situations in their history in which they were in terrible debt, and they know the pain that that endures. I didn't necessarily buy that, but I thought it was an interesting attempt to explain away the German insistence on enforcing the creditors' terms at all expenses.
All right, wild card line, Will is in Matt.
Well, there you go. Now you know where Jesus' money's at. The baby Jesus money, yeah, right, because God and Jesus need all the money they can get. Well, I was up into the wee hours recording this off the satellite, so I didn't get much sleep, so I'm going to include this program in the show, and I'll just put a heading on for the show, and then you can open this up. I think it's a valuable piece of information in that book. One thing about these authors, if they're good, by the time they get done, you don't really have to read the book. However, I'm sure there's a lot of more juicy stuff in the book. So that's it for today, boys and girls. I'll be back tomorrow on Tuesday, and sorry about Saturday. I don't know what was going on there, but I had a little trouble with shows bouncing back that I sent to people. So I finally discovered that I evidently had not sent it out. And so I had to go into my files there and find it again and send it out yesterday. So whenever that stuff happens, if you can't get to me, well, get to merchandiseresist@yahoo.com and she'll take care of you. 14-5 and see you tomorrow, Tuesday. Oh, incidentally, I'm declaring the Kosciuszko County where I live as a sanctuary, white sanctuary county. I sent that information out to several black talk show hosts. We'll see what happens.